Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J this morning. John Cass of JohnCassNews.com famed Chicago columnist. John.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'm still recovering from that tongue lashing I received from you at my roast.
Actually, I was quite gentle.
Were you?
I was gentle with you. Compared to Janie and Amy.
Compared to them, yeah. It was a proper pounding, as I said. I enjoyed it. All right, John Cass writing at JohnCassNews.com about one mayor triple threat. I've covered politics a long time in Chicago. I've never seen a mayor so weak, so ridiculed. So, John, tell me how she's going to win re-election despite that characterization of the weakest mayor in your lifetime.
Size does matter. According to Lori Lightfoot, size is important. She wants the biggest, most bigliest group of people to support her, to oppose her. It's all about survival math. The larger the number of people in the race with her incumbency, I would assume that's the only way she can make it to the runoff.
Well, okay, but then how does she make it out of the runoff when it does come down to two candidates if she is so weak and so ridiculed? Do you think that she is a dead woman walking politically? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Because, I mean, I haven't seen any recent polling on her when I asked this question. And I know many of our listeners will say, well, of course, I don't know anybody who doesn't ridicule her. I don't know anybody who would support her, anybody who would vote for her. But that's a little bit of a Pauline Kael situation, too.
Right.
The polling I saw, I mean, it's a few months ago now, and it's gotten a lot worse. But, I mean, you know, she still had an approval rating in the low 40s. I mean, it's not disqualifying. So that there are people out there so oblivious or so in the tank that do support her. But, again, to your scenario, so she has a big field in the primary, which is not that far away, February of next year.
Already afoot.
Well, of course, we've had Alderman Ray Lopez announce he's running. Willie Wilson has announced he's running again. Mm-hmm. Paul Vallis is expected to announce that he's running again. So how does she survive a runoff, or are you saying she can't?
I'm saying that. First things first, if you're going to try to survive, you need a big field of opponents. And then you watch as they all rip each other. And we get into that tribal politics of race and who's blacker, who's not as pure, who's I'm more black than Dan Proft, which is, obvious. And that's the kind of rhetoric we're going to hear is, the city tears itself apart. Although I did also mention, Dan, and I almost forgot it because I was hunting rabbits in the creek bed, but I did mention.
You and Joe talking about high capacity magazines?
You got to have those ghost guns. The rabbits don't even know when you got a ghost gun on you.
Yeah, no, I understand.
She could walk away. I mean, today's column at JohnCassNews.com. Thank you.
Subscriptions still available, I understand.
Yes, they are. She very well might or could walk away. And I think there would
be no way.
But I know, but I you just offer it. It might be the best for the city. Walk away. do a little like free legal work for, you know, Kim Fox. You know, help
sure,
her out.
Sure, yeah, she go work in the Cook County State's Attorney's office. Right. It's a perfect landing spot for her.
Public defender.
I mean, there's no chance she walks away, right? You don't believe there's any chance she walks away. The idea that anybody would do anything selfless in the interest of the city obviously is a punchline. But when we're talking about Chicago, but there's no way. Her identity now is so wrapped up in this office, and she's so enjoying it. I'm sure she doesn't enjoy a lot of the ridicule. I think to
she
some
went
extent,
to the Wiener Circle.
Well, she wanted to size herself up, but I mean, I think in a perverse way, she enjoys a lot of the ridicule because it's just that much more attention. And that's what she craves after somebody who was ignored for most of her adult life.
Right.
And you know, this is her turn to wear the sash. This is her turn to be the cool kid. And from the dress up to the celebrity stuff.
Costumes.
Yeah, the Rona Busters, all that. She likes it. And I don't think the ridicule bothers her. So, and frankly,
it would bother Dan Proft.
No, yeah. Right.
We would call people out for duels on LaSalle Street.
Exactly. French Revolution style. But don't you see, I mean, I this is, you know, armchair psychoanalysis.
Right.
I don't know her, but she wasn't expected by most to win in 2019. She, you know, some people will write her political epitaph and that will just encourage her more. It seems to me, I don't think there's any way that she steps away.
This is the tree of life, because you see that there's so much on this story, even though she's a failure. One thing is that whoever is the mayor, who becomes the mayor, can't really do much on crime without the help of the state's attorney and the person in charge of the state's attorney, who's been shrinking the size of the jail. That's Tony Preckwinkle. And nobody, even the Republicans, aren't challenging her. The Democrats aren't going to challenge her. The press, clearly, I'm not on the editorial board of a great metropolitan newspaper anymore, but the editorials boards aren't challenging Tony Preckwinkle.
Well, and they're also going to make a calculation based on what the alternatives are. And you know, I can't see, you know, Ray Lopez. Yeah, he's gotten into some verbal sparring matches with her, and he's, you know, promoted the idea of a more proactive police department.
And residency, which is an attention getter.
Yeah.
And rank and file FOP. And
and your guy, Paul Vallis, and I like him too. You know, he's got the intellectual and policy chops for the job, but he's never been able to put together a real constituency. And he's, you know, and he's been sort of politically all over the place, particularly when he ran as Pat Quinn's running mate.
Mistake.
Big yeah, mistake, it was
like
a mistake.
Willie Wilson says.
It was a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having a hard time seeing how a Vallis or a Wilson or a Lopez unseats her. I'm still underwhelmed by the prospect of her losing sans something very different than what we've seen before.
I've told, you know, Paul's a friend of mine, as you know. And
yeah.
I've told him not to run unless you get, you know, several million. I would want $10 million. See, the political class in this town and in this state, the political donor class is exceedingly corrupt, as you know, and they just don't like Paul Vallis. There's got to be a reason why they don't like the guy, you know?
Yeah,
and it's because he's not one of theirs. I don't know if it's like, do they not like Greeks? I don't know.
I don't know if it's that, but I agree that he's I don't know. I don't know what it is exactly, actually. I mean, it's not like there are people that write checks to other candidates that are not, you know, part of their social circle or that are not part of the in crowd. But there does seem to be still this idea among the statist class in Chicago of having a wink and a nod to say that somebody's acceptable.
They were all over Ernie the White Shadow Duncan, Penny Pritzker, the Widow Jobes, other people I respect, people I don't respect, were all on that.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't pull the trigger because he saw what was coming and he didn't have the management. You know, it's one thing to play defense for Barack Obama on the pickup game and pass to him and block out for him. It's another thing to have to run the city yourself.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, Barack can't do both. He can't be the shadow president and the shadow mayor.
What does that even mean? He doesn't do anything. It's just speechifying and putting, you know, his flax in positions of authority. But, you know, I mean, isn't there like some daily relative that we could put up again? I mean, are there no dailies left, John?
Don't we need any more? We need some more Chinatown references, don't we?
Yes.
And, you know, like, I was telling...
is there anybody from the Rub and Tug set that we could put up again?
Well, I had Ray Lopez on the podcast the other day, and he was talking about the price of concrete and the price of asphalt. And so, you know, clearly I said, Ray, I hope a car doesn't come for you pick you up for spaghetti dinner in Chinatown at midnight.
Yeah.
Just don't get in the car.
Right. And it's going to be like the opening episode of The Boss.
Right. But there he is, you know, Ray Lopez fighting for
is there anybody, you know, we play this intermittently over the last couple of years. We play this fantasy politics.
Right.
You know, pick somebody, anybody to that you would recruit to run for mayor if you had your druthers, and I, you know, try to come up with a name that's interesting. And the only name I've really come up with over that time period during Triple Threat's illustrious tenure is Bob Mazikowski, who runs Chicago Hope Academy.
Oh, well, that's a real...
He's not going to do it, but, no. I mean, he would be great, and that's the kind of person that cuts across a lot of different constituencies, and he's got a great record in the corporate world, as well as obviously what he's done with Chicago Hope Academy and educating kids mainly from poor neighborhoods. I think that would be a really interesting candidate, and I think he could be a great mayor, but he's not going to do it. So somebody like that is what I'm thinking. Do you have any thoughts?
You need someone to challenge the teachers' union.
All right.
You can't talk about violent crime, and that's the number one issue in Chicago and Cook County. Without talking about education, but throwing money at education, you know, that all that nonsense that I've been watching for half a century now doesn't work.
Yeah, and if it comes down to Vallis and Lightfoot, you're gonna push the teachers union back with Lightfoot of all things. That's where they'll have to be.
To witness Stacey Davis Gates and Lori Lightfoot in political bed together might be worth the price of a ticket.
So no names. You don't have any great insight. Somebody that we should be leveling up and talking about publicly to encourage them to do something they might not otherwise be inclined to do.
Well, I think that what you need to – the city is in such a bad shape now, Dan, that you need somebody who can manage, who understands the departments, the interplay between, you know, like the old Department of Transportation guys.
Yeah.
From Norridge and the streets and sand, you need someone who understands Chicago. And Chicago Hope Academy, I mean, that's an impressive man, and I'm sure there are others, but you need somebody steeped in the mechanism of Chicago immediately, because we're at such a crisis situation that if they don't do something soon, the whole thing goes into the toilet.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, like the big.
biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J is John Kay, as in John Cass, johncassnews.com. And before Mike Scott's newscast, we were talking about the mayor's race a bit, since it's only about 10 months away, and triple threats chances of re-election. So let's expand on that and talk about lawlessness and disorder in big blue city America, including Chicago more generally. I know this portends to be the inflation election, but violent crime, particularly in urban centers, but not limited to, and a lot of mid-size urban communities, too. It's not just the biggest cities. It's enough of an issue where Joe Biden and the left felt they needed to have something to talk about on the topic. Since they can't talk about their mayors and their prosecutors, they're talking about ghost guns and high-capacity magazines and assault weapon bans again, as you heard we discussed yesterday. But there are little things sometimes that tell you a lot about the state of play in a particular community. And I don't love this story in the sense that I'm happy it occurred, of course, but I love this story because I think it tells you about the state of play in Chicago. Trevor Siemian, a fellow Northwestern grad, amazing that this guy has bounced around the NFL as long as he has, actually. He was signed recently, you may have heard, as the backup to Justin Fields by the Bears, the Arlington Heights Bears. They're a pro football team in Chicago, the Chicagoland area now. He's coming back to Chicago, and here's his welcome back. He got a start. He got his car stolen, that is, out of the Beverly Country Club parking lot. John.
Well, you know, Beverly Country Club, I thought, was a place that where Irish guys with bad plaid pants played golf.
I thought it was a safe haven. I mean, how could Ed Burke let this happen? Where was Mike Madigan at Beverly Country Club when you need him? He was driving a Dodge SRT. That got lifted, and another car owned by Michael Gallagher, who's the managing director at Morgan Stanley, was the second car stolen. Two cars stolen out of the parking lot of Beverly Country Club. Not only, you know, a sanctuary for Irish politicians, but also a lot of those connected guys you were talking about a little bit earlier when we were talking about Chicago politics.
Yeah. But, didn't they used to have, there were always like retired coppers hanging around there doing security and stuff. Who was there?
Well, apparently they need to hire those gun-sniffing dogs that Neiman Marcus is using now, and maybe guys that are not off-duty. I mean, you know, yes, off-duty cops, but maybe a little bit more firepower from the neighborhood, if you will. I mean, <It's laughs> cars stolen from the parking lot at Beverly Country Club?
It's ridiculous, but, you know, to your larger point, they changed the subject because they have to. They must. Crime is a big issue that's going to drive many minorities to the Republican Party, and they can't have it. So they have to gin up ghost guns. You know, they don't want to talk about Soros prosecutors like Kim Fox. So they'll talk ghost guns, create ghost gun language, which is out of whole cloth, and redefine the law and the Constitution in order to create a bogeyman, which is what? The guy in his basement building a ghost gun for terrorist purposes?
Yeah, but it's something that you said, it's going to drive minority voters to the ranks of the Republicans. Is it? Is that what you think is going to happen? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I just don't know. I know we're supposed to take solace in Eric Adams's victory in New York City as some sort of rebuke of de Blasio and defund police.
But then he came to Chicago, didn't talk to Lori Lightfoot to get her advice on solving crime.
Well, it sounds, I think so, that was,
that, what the heck?
Well, you know, and I think it's a poor choice on his part, but that was seemed to me like somebody called in a political favor. Can you come here and pretend like you're seeking her advice and try to prop her up a little bit? Can you stand with Lori Lightfoot? She could use a bit of a backstop at this moment. Although, you know, Eric Adams is, as we've talked about a few times now in the last week, he's talking the talk of broken windows and getting back to the sort of policing that cleaned up New York City back in the 80s. And yet, what do we have? We have lawlessness breaking out in New York City like they haven't seen. We're used to it. Like they haven't seen in a long time. Not only did you have that terrible subway shooting yesterday, but you also had another 12 people shot and three people murdered in New York in about 8 hours after yesterday, after that subway shooting. And thankfully, Michael have updates on this, but I think that the 10 people who were shot, none have died so far. So that's incredible, actually, since he just opened fire in a confined space like that. But that's what I understand to be the case. So hopefully everybody survives. But obviously that was reminiscent of Colin Ferguson on the Long Island Rail 30 years ago. And that's reminiscent of a time when New York needed to be cleaned up.
Sooner or later, there's going to be maybe the Democrats are hoping for a Bernard Goetz. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. And then they'll have something to, you know, refocus their laser beam intellects upon.
Well, you know, it's interesting because New York, they're feeling it politically. I don't know if I'm talking about the Democrat Socialists. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're feeling it politically here yet. Some of the hijinks in the General Assembly with this quote-unquote Safety Act would seem to indicate that they're not. But, you know, Kathy Hochul, the accidental governor there, who's now without a lieutenant governor, isn't that sad?
Mm.
The lieutenant governor you probably saw, he resigned after being indicted and on a campaign fraud charges yesterday. So that's sad to leave a void like that. But Kathy Hochul, recent polling, has her running in a dead heat with Congressman Lee Zeldin for governor, for re-election this year. So that's sort of interesting. I mean, I still am skeptical that a Republican will win statewide in New York State, but they're worried about it enough that that the state chairman, the state socialist chairman, Jay Jacobs, and Hochul wanted to create a new ballot line for vulnerable incumbents. They wanted an option so you don't have to run under the Democrat banner.
They wanted their
candidates to be able to run as independents on the ballot.
Right, like Chicago did when they switched the mayoral election to
nonpartisan. Yeah, go nonpartisan.
Right.
That does tell you something about a feeling like this brand is an albatross right now.
Well,
as long as people don't feel safe in New York City, it's going to continue to be an albatross.
Except for the fact that in New York, there's at least the Post, the New York Post. In Chicago, outside of Dan Proft and maybe a little bit of me, where are the Democratic Socialists being called to account media-wise? So they have their choir.
Yeah.
They preach to their choir, and the people go along.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think directionally you're right that this is moving numbers. The crime issue is moving numbers of traditional Democrat voters, including minorities, to the center and to the center right to vote for Republicans in some states. I think you're seeing interesting things happening in Pennsylvania, in Nevada.
Not here.
But it may be in New York, but that's the question. What about here?
Because we don't have a Republican Party, like I told you earlier.
Do they really have one in New York State?
Well, I mean, I don't know what their
not really
inner workings are. But I'll tell you, if the Republican Party, Ken Griffin and all his money, and Mike Z and all his brains, which I doubt, and all those people around them, if they're not challenging Tony Preckwinkle, who is the at the center of the web on, you know, criminal justice, crime, the release of inmates, the shrinking of the jail. If they're not doing that, then they're really not about anything, to me, as far as I'm concerned.
Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, you know, I was looking at one of those changeover maps from 2016 to 2020. It was from the New York Times, and I did look at the Chicagoland area. There might have been one or two neighborhoods that swung in Trump's direction, but there were some neighborhoods that are largely black and Latino in places like Elgin, Aurora, and Joliet that swung towards Trump quite considerably. And although they're considered suburbs, they are kind of communities unto themselves.
Yeah.
And you're right, Dan. It does depend on where you're at. I don't think you're gonna see much change in Chicago because there's no real Republican opposition in that city. But in order to get more of these people onto the Republican side, you got to run more populist Republicans. You're not going to do it with traditional Republicans because they just don't buy that message, especially on economic issues.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
Last time I saw that phenomenon was Jim Thompson in a black church singing in the choir and trying to clap in tune.
Yeah.
It's so pathetic. You know, just walk away.
Well, so right. I mean, the pantomiming outreach. But I mean, you know, even sans outreach, do you see in from some of the communities Mike and Plano mentioned, you know, they have Democrat socialist Congress beings. They have Democrat socialist state legislators. Do you see Lauren Underwood getting thrown out in November? Do you see Sean Casten being thrown out in November? And they could be facing some pretty good candidates, perhaps Pekow against Casten, perhaps Mike Coolidge against Lauren Underwood.
Yes.
Or there's a couple other candidates to that. So, you know, you have viable alternatives in those races, and that's why I wonder if people hear or feel some movement of the ground underneath them in those communities. Yeah, I mean, Chicago's, when I say Chicago, I'm talking about Chicagoland. Maybe it's not happening in the city proper, but maybe it is happening in the western burbs, the northwestern burbs, even the southwest burbs. And I'm sort of asking the question because it feels like it should be happening. Maybe you see some numbers that indicate it might be happening, but you don't see the kind of movement that you're seeing in a lot of other states, including states that are saddled with, you know, big sucking chest wounds like we are with Chicago.
And that's a tragedy, isn't it, for the people themselves?
Well, and the question is, you know, maybe I'm missing it. Maybe there is something afoot that is not perceptible unless you're, you know, part of it or in it. You live in a particular neighborhood or community, or you're part of a particular community demographically. I suppose
the thing is that to think in terms of a wave coming in November, but if you don't take advantage of that sentiment and have candidates like you mentioned, the two that are especially Casten and Underwood, but if you don't take advantage of it as a party, as an organization.
Well, right. I mean, everybody keeps it big. It's going to be a big red wave. It's going to be a big red wave. Okay, that's fine. And you want to encourage people, hey, get ready to surf the wave so you don't get crushed underneath it. Okay, fine. But then why do you think it? And what are you doing to grow it, to your point?
Yeah.
Jim in Sheboygan.
So in California, there's the Postal Service refuses to deliver mail to a high-end community outside of L.A.
Santa Monica.
Postal.
Yeah.
Yeah, because their postal folks have been robbed and whatnot. So in San Francisco, some of the tech companies aren't allowing their people to come into work because they've been robbed and whatnot as they're coming into work. So my hope is that as crime affects people, obviously minorities the most, but as it affects the upper class, hopefully they'll start contributing and they'll understand the problem more widespread. And maybe they'll push more towards getting rid of some of these Democrats who aren't doing anything on crime. Milwaukee, murders are up 90%. Across the country, murders are up 20 to 30%. And That's after setting records last year.
That's right.
So crime is huge, and so the other people that I'm hoping open their eyes are the cream puff young people who went Democratic, who are afraid of COVID. I'm sure they got to be afraid of crime too. So I'm hoping that switches as well.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, you know, maybe even the combine financiers, if they can't feel safe at Beverly Country Club, maybe they'll even come over. John.
Back in the old days, they'd show up at a meeting somewhere on Lake Street or Ogden and talk to the big guy. And now, who do they talk to?
Yeah. Right. Where do I get my protection? Tina and Joliet.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Tina.
So I help gather signatures for Republican candidates in Cook County. And we went all over Beverly and Mount Greenwood. And without hesitation, every woman, I only had one woman decline to sign a petition, but it was men, 50% of the men. They were, it was all tradesmen, and they refused to sign. They're voting Democrat no matter what. And if the Republicans don't appeal to the women in this election, it's done. They are livid. They're afraid. They want better for their kids. They're disgusted with what's happening in our schools. And that is the pivotal election block of people to go after. Go after these women because they are mad.
The hand that rocks the cradle, whether it's crime in Chicago or, you know, fentanyl across the border in waves. Women are, I agree with Tina.
Thanks for that call, Tina. Thanks for that comment, John Cass. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J., Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Was that when you were wearing those puffy pants into breakdancing?
That was more of the 80s. Can you name that artist? No, you can't. No, so can't. I'll tell you. It's Mark Morrison. One hit wonder. He's such a talented guy, but he had a lot of problems with the law over there in the UK. Return of the Mac is the song, but I'm talking about Return of the Mask. Did you see what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very clever. If I do say so myself, John Cass in for Amy J. this morning, johncassnews.com. Return of the mask in Philadelphia. Indoor mask mandate effective on Monday. Businesses will be required to impose a mask requirement on their patrons. We had in Chicago. And I don't know. If New York did it again, I'm not saying they will, but if they did, then we definitely do it again. I don't know if Philadelphia has enough status for us to mimic, John.
Well, Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania, correct?
I believe so.
And don't the Democrats want us to go back to mail-in voting? I mean, how can we go cast our ballots like true Americans in person if we're afraid of COVID?
They just won't let it go.
No, they
and
won't.
Of course, there's a lot of mixed messages from the certified COVID experts. How do you know they're experts? Because they've been so deemed by the cable news networks. So a mask mandate going back into effect in Philadelphia on that same day, Monday, April 18th. We're supposed to hear whether or not the mask mandate will be lifted on passengers on commercial airlines. I wouldn't get my hopes up. Ashish Jha, who is Brown University, Dr. Ashish Jha, he's also a COVID advisor to Biden World. He had this to say.
Well, let me just ask you, Dr. Jha, does that mean that extending the mask mandate in public transportation is a live option? It's on the table?
Yeah, I look, this is a CDC decision, and I think it is absolutely on the table. And Dr. Walensky is going to make her decision based on the framework that the CDC scientists create, and we'll make a decision collectively based on that.
That doesn't sound very encouraging.
What are they making their decision on?
A CDC framework,
just
whatever
what they
that
feel
is.
Like? Yeah, right. I mean, there's not... Once you have them used to going into the chutes and accepting the ring in their nose, the game's over, right?
Well, something else, too. This went unnoticed by the deep thinkers on the Today Show. but it's a CDC decision. No, it isn't. I'm sorry. No, it's not a CDC decision. It's a decision by our elected officials. The CDC is a public health agency that provides advice and consent to elected officials who make the policy decisions. That's how it's supposed to work. I know that's not how it works because the COVIDians have just ceded all executive and legislative authority to public health agencies like the CDC and these unelected appointed doctors. But no, that's not how it works. It's a CDC decision. No, Dr. Jha, it's not a CDC decision. Or at least it shouldn't be.
What's Fauci doing? What is St. Fauci? Is he back from the mountain?
Fauci was, he got another star turn on the big boy shows on Sunday. He doesn't have to do cable access right now. He's back on This Week. And he was asked about one of the other topics du jour under all things COVID. About vaccinations, will it be an annual thing? About masking, about large events. We're back to now talking. Here we go again. We got Philadelphia with a mask, indoor mask mandate. And now we're talking again about large events and whether you should go to large events, whether you should go maskless to large events.
How can you have people vote at a school or a church or some... you know, voting place that isn't a large event, that isn't dangerous.
Here's Fauci changing his tune a little bit. Take a listen.
I think it gets back to what we were discussing just a moment ago, John. It's going to be a person's decision about the individual risk they're going to take. Mm-hmm. I think the people who run functions, who run big dinners, who run functions like the White House mm-hmm. Correspondents' Ball, or thinking back the gridiron dinner, are going to have to make a determination looking at the CDC guidelines and seeing where the trends are. I mean, there are some places you go, not only is it required that you show proof of vaccination, but you have to have a negative test the day you go to a particular place.
Yep.
And I know a lot of social functions throughout Washington and in New York are doing the same thing. And it's up to the individual to determine what their level of risk. We don't want to poo-poo getting infected. I think people sometimes say, well, it's okay to get infected. No, it's not, because there are things like long COVID, and there are sometimes people, even though they don't require hospitalization, John, they get significantly ill. They may be at home, they may require a doctor consultation, but they don't get hospitalized. That's not something to poo-poo. Again, sure. Each individual will have to take their own determination of risk.
All right, don't go poo-pooing Tony Fauci. Now it's everybody's making an individual determination about their risk tolerance. So, I mean, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth behind a mask, as per usual. On the one hand, he'll say that. On the other hand, he'll recommend all of the mitigations, as they euphemistically call them. And he'll back the play of the CDC if they extend the mask mandate on airlines and public transportation. He'll back Philadelphia with the reimposition of the mask mandate, nonsensical as it may be.
As long as he's the apex predator, he'll go along, you know?
You know, it's funny, where all this stems from, this was a topic that was tackled by Eugippius, who's, obviously a gnome de plume.
Right.
Who's got a site like Alex Berenson and others. And he talks a little bit about the mask obsession and how, despite its pointlessness, it persists. Theories about why that might be. He suggests maybe early on it was copying the Asia-Pacific region because mm-hmm. the perception was they were handling it better and that they're more oriented toward mask wearing from previous pandemics and they know what they're doing, so let's follow their lead. I mean, remember how much we were embracing the COVIDians, when I say we, not me, but the COVIDians were embracing these hard lockdowns that the Chi-Coms were imposing.
Yes, the only thing we didn't have were drones telling us that ignore what our souls were calling us to do.
Yes, please control your soul's desire for freedom.
Right.
In Shanghai, literally right now, people losing their minds because they are locked down. Speaking of draconian lockdowns from March of 2020, how about in real time in Shanghai? People screaming from the windows of these high rises because they are literally not allowed to go out of their apartment for any reason.
This is 正常的叫啊。
I mean, it's chilling video that that Chinese gentleman is describing, but you hear the background, and he just has basically the view of high rises, and you just hear the din of people screaming to no particular end, just out of exasperation
and hysteria. Yeah.
And as you mentioned, literally, we mentioned this a few days ago, drones the Chinese government is sending out to respond to these wails, cry freedom. Please comply with COVID restrictions. Control your soul's desire for freedom. Do not open the window or sing. That's what these drones are blaring out as they're flying over these high rises with people screaming. I mean, you cannot, sci-fi cannot keep up with the policy choices that are being made, including in the West. Don't forget, and here's a prime example of it, sort of a salient one, since he's now a Republican candidate for Senate in Pennsylvania. He hasn't got out of the primary yet, but he's running in that primary to be the nominee to run to hold Pat Toomey's seat since he's retiring, keep that in Republican hands. Dr. Oz, who's been endorsed by Donald Trump. This was Dr. Oz in March of 2020, the outset of the lockdowns, just in terms of thinking about this with all COVID policy, lockdowns as well as mask wearing.
And the Chinese numbers have dropped dramatically, which is fantastic news. And it's also valuable for us to understand why they were able to do that. If you look inside of Wuhan province, they had a catastrophe. But outside the province, which, of course, they quarantined in the largest movement of its nature ever, 60 million people blocked in that space. But the rest of the country was relatively spare. They didn't have the big spikes, the huge crises that Wuhan experienced. And it took the country to in a very different direction. We just have to copy what they did. Take their blueprint and repeat it here in this country. And
really?
So where does he stand then?
Well, I don't know where he stands today, and I don't know. I haven't seen a mea culpa for those statements back in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. I know we're supposed to give people wide berth and say, we didn't know very much then. And people were afraid.
Right.
But the idea that you would ever say, almost on anything, that we should copy the Chinese communist blueprint and implement it here, that is a statement that should never be made about anything the Chinese communists are doing.
It's a disqualifier, immediate.
That's not to Trump.
To me. No, well, I'm sorry, I don't pray at the altar of Trump. I'm a conservative, not a Trumpian. And I'm not one of these anti-Trumpers either. But it just confounds me.
That's an incredible statement that Dr. Oz made, and boy, I assume there are going to be Republicans who are in a pitch battle in the primary against him who call him to account for that. So we'll see what he says.
Has
if you want
waited?
To walk it back, if you want to apologize, okay, fine, people make mistakes, but boy, that the instinct there to say something like yeah. that, by the way, to believe whatever was coming out of China in terms of how well they're handling the outbreak, to believe anything is incredibly naive at best. Joe in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, John. I think it's worth considering the return to this mask fiasco as a strategy that Dems are considering in light of the beating we're anticipating they're going to get in the midterms. That's somehow getting people back on the fear wagon, saying they're saving us, or maybe just manipulating the election again, or maybe something more devious that my wholesome mind can't think of.
Mm. Interesting. Thanks.
Concerns
for the call,
me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shut down the vote.
All mail-in ballots, right? Yeah. And by the way, Philadelphia, you may recall, for those who paid some attention to the 2020 election, Philadelphia was one of those urban centers that outperformed for Biden as compared to Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. One of those key urban centers in one of those swing states that outperformed for Biden, where he underperformed the rest of the country. It was, you know, Maricopa County. It was Milwaukee. It was Philadelphia. It was Atlanta, Georgia. Very surgical was Biden's outperformance of Hillary Clinton in 2020, wasn't it? But remember, Philadelphia was one of them, one of those cities, per Joe in Arlington Heights' point about what Democrats may be thinking. I don't know.
You know what? I think that they go there, then you're going to have serious problems in terms of law enforcement.
Well, the other thing is, thankfully, you've had a couple of dozen states move to reform their election laws in the interim. You have legislators in those states, a lot of Republican-controlled legislative bodies that have moved to reassert their power, their legislative power, when it comes to election integrity. So it seems to me less likely that it seems to me unlikely you'll see a repeat of 2020 and 2024.
With respect, you're so wrong, because I haven't read the Tribune in, like, I don't know, light years, but I did happen to look at an editorial the other day, and they were talking about voter oppression, voter suppression.
Yeah.
We don't need these stinking laws.
That may fly in Illinois. I'm saying it's not going to fly in places like Georgia, like it did in 2020.
Yes.
I don't think so. Here's something interesting, too, just in terms of the mentality, because, you know, you're trying to crawl into the minds of these COVIDian loons.
Scary.
This from Mary Harrington over at Unheard. She dissecting and digesting some polling out of Canada. Ecos Politics polled a random sample of 1,000 Canadians, stratified the results by vaccination status. The question, do you support a no-fly zone enforced by NATO? So the overlay is your vax status. By vax status, what is the support for no-fly zone among Canadians, you know, enforced by the West in Ukraine?
Mm-hmm.
59% who received three or more doses support a no-fly zone. 34% who received two doses support a no-fly zone. Only 18% of those who refused to get vaccinated support a no-fly zone.
Does that vaccine have anything to do to stop nuclear fallout when we push this nonsense to the point where we get a nuclear war?
No, but think about that. Isn't that an interesting stratification?
Yeah, what does it tell us? That the left is all about pushing the war now in Ukraine, and the conservatives, or those who are apt to avoid the vaccine, are not for escalation of a war. Is that basically, do I have it right?
I think, yeah, you're over the target, so to speak.
But generally.
But right. Yeah, it really is interesting, though. I mean, it says a lot about the mentality.
Well, what is the mentality of all this stuff, all the tweeting, all the, you know, the I've got a Ukraine flag on my lapel pin or on my Twitter picture. What is that about? Is it about changing the subject from what's happening to give people a jumping off ramp so they can talk about something that rather than, you know, Biden's failures economically and politically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, going from one moral panic to the other.
Yes.
and going to the next, whatever's popular. But how does it become popular? Mary Harrington writes, humans have probably always clustered by belief to an extent, but it's been evident since at least 2016 that social media greatly accelerates the intensity of this dynamic by unmooring it from material life. I can't very well cancel my local butcher if we disagree about vaccines or Ukraine. At least not if I want to buy a steak off him tomorrow. But if I do my grocery shopping online, I can demonize and expel to my heart's content. Lockdown scaled this up radically, forcing as much as possible of our common life away from in-person interactions to the internet. And this has radically intensified ideological clustering and tribalization. That's her argument, and that's her explanation for this this cross-section of vaccination status with support of no-fly zone. It's really an interesting cross-tab, isn't it?
I want to read it.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
What I think it is that over the last 30 years, especially, the educational system, especially in terms of the teaching of history and political science, has really, you know, really hurt our kids. I mean, it's really failed our kids. They don't know. A lot of people don't know much of anything. So when you wind up having our liberties being taken away and you wind up having this war going on in Ukraine, everybody's just flashing their, you know, little Ukrainian flags and putting all those signs out and all that. They don't know any better anyway. So they just go with what's on Twitter and with what's on Facebook and everything else. And it's really pathetic. But I will say this. I've been teaching the Pax Americana unit, which is basically Truman through Bush 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same way the last 3-4 years. And the kids seem to gravitate. I don't propagate it at all. Okay, I'm very neutral. I don't even know what they have no idea what I am, and they really seem to like Reagan. I'm a little bit surprised because I don't know much about him, but the kids seem to know that there's something special about him even before I teach about his foreign policy and his economic plans. So, I mean, there's something out there with the kids at least. I think they know that he was a great president, and that's one positive that I see. But overall, at the whole country level, what do we teach kids in history? DBQs. What does that do them? It teaches them how to look at a couple documents and write, which you know, there's value to that, but it's at the expense of enough historical breadth that people are just ignorant of what's really going on, and they don't know how to respond, so they just go with what's popular.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. this morning. JohnCassNews.com is where you find his writings. John.
Hey, Dan.
We Christians celebrate Easter on Sunday, the 17th.
Be careful. The heretics, my heretic friends celebrate it this Sunday. And I hope they... Everyone has a blessed Easter. I was just joking about the heritage.
I know. Well, here's the thing.
But I'm fasting from whiteness.
Oh, exactly. And I think the thing to bridge your Easter with my Easter is you continue fasting from whiteness until your Easter, right? That would be appropriate.
Well, the Orthodox generally fast from whiteness because many of the others don't consider us white, and we've decided to go with it. Yeah, this is the most ridiculous thing. I don't know what that's about.
Well, I think, as usual, you have intellectual leadership from those hippie refugees in Oak Park. We mentioned this story a couple of times now. It became an international story. I think maybe the fasting from whiteness, particularly for these honkies at the First United Church in Oak Park, mm-hmm. should continue beyond Easter, don't you? I mean, if it's good enough to fast from whiteness for 40 days, why not 365? Why not in perpetuity? Just to refresh your recollection.
Thank you.
In case anybody thinks that making this up, here is the good Reverend Linda Mulkey announcing at their first Lenten Mass the fasting from whiteness that these aging honkies in Oak Park are going to do for Lent.
Some things in your life, perhaps you have taken up a Lenten fast from chocolate, or from television, or from some other thing in your life. The fast that we are choosing this year at First United may not be one that you have chosen before. It may seem like a strange kind of fast. We are fasting from whiteness. Now, in this fast from whiteness, of course, I cannot change the color of my skin or the way that allows me to move through the world, but I can change what I listen to, whose voice I prioritize. And so that is kind of the plan for our worship services through Lent.
How about Jesus' voice?
That we would fast for a time from prioritizing white voices, and that we would use the music and poetry of Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and see what the Spirit might do among us.
The Spirit has moved me to fast from the honkies at First United in Oak Park for the rest of my days, John. I don't know about you.
I think, I'd like to climb up on a platform of, in a tree and without any leaves on it, and just sit there forever, watching them go in and out.
Concurrent with that, we have a renewed call for reparations. It's not just for Evanston anymore.
Really?
Oak Park, this will help us heal old wounds. This profile piece in Crane Chicago Business, the anti-business magazine in Chicago, going back to your point about there are no media outlets that are in any way sane in Chicago, so it's a bit difficult to get the word out. Christian Harris, ironic Christian, a former Oak Park Library Board trustee who ran for seat on the Village Board in 2018, co-founded grassroots group Walk the Walk and blah, 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 and did this wide-ranging interview with Cranes. Reparations are a means of addressing the wealth and opportunity gaps that residents experience due to historic racism and discrimination, blah, 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 blah. Oak Park undermined the ability of Black residents to build community and wealth going back at least to the early 1900s. I guess the fasting from whiteness at First United is not enough for Mr. Harris. As a result, I would like to see a long-term reparations plan that gives Black people the opportunity to build community and wealth in Oak Park. This might be direct grants to Black residents, low-interest business and real estate loans, tax reimbursements, child care, community spaces, and revisions to the school curriculum, among many other possibilities. They're still working it through, but he wants to get the ball rolling. What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, speak in favor of this poor man. Is it a man or a woman?
Christian Harris, man. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speak on his or her behalf, these and them behalf. I mean, they want change, right? She wants change or he wants change. And what better way to do it than to force others into your, political view?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the thing about the, I mean, we've talked about reparations before when Evanston made international news by providing, actually setting aside money
for
home ownership grants for black residents and so forth, because, you know, there's no opportunity for black people in communities controlled by Democrat socialists. That's what I'm hearing from the Evanstonians and from the Oak Parkers. Right. Isn't that interesting and ironic? Of course, the irony is lost on them. But, you know, all this this business is always focused retrospectively on restorative justice and healing old wounds. And we've talked at considerable length about America's history, warts and all. Mm-hmm. Happy to discuss it. Not afraid to talk about the terrible things that were done to black people in this country by white people as well as by other black people. The terrible things that continue to be done by people to people because, you know, human beings are flawed and this is a messy business, this thing called society, and there's a lot of ugliness, and that's too bad, and I wish it wasn't that way. And you try to do your best to make it not that way. Obsessing about race doesn't seem to be a much of a way forward to this shared end that we say we want, but okay. But instead of just retrospectively, if we want to talk about wealth creation and opportunity and the American dream and its accessibility, how about just in present? How about like first order priorities? And the first order priority, which we were talking a bit about earlier in the show, John, is stop killing each other. How about that? How about let's get some sort of baseline laid down? Stop the violence. And I'm not limiting this to the black neighborhoods or black majority black communities. I'm talking about generally, but specifically because black Americans are disproportionately crime victims at about three times the rate of their population, as well as violent crime committers. So where is the emphasis on that? You know, because if you're a crime victim or you're a violent criminal, that turns out to be terribly destructive well beyond you, the victim, or you, the criminal. You know, that has ripple effects within a community. Have you seen South Suburban Cook County lately? Have you seen the South and West Sides of Chicago? So when you have lawlessness reign and you participate in it or you rationalize it, it's going to be difficult to have a serious conversation about how you bring entrepreneurship and economic opportunity to people that are including the law-abiding, that are trapped by those who are not law-abiding.
When kids are getting shot off the porch and or wherever they're getting shot, and the chief judge of Cook County says that the shooters don't know the difference between right and wrong because their cerebral cortex has not been developed fully, and so we should grant them mercy, I wonder how many people want to invest in such communities.
I want to say one more thing about the violence, because I want to go back. I want to take this back one step, but let's take a couple calls real quick. Marty in Brookfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey guys, I've been thinking about school district borders and applying the logic of our national border. I think parents who live in the Austin neighborhood should march their kids across Austin Avenue and demand that they go into the Oak Park schools because no student is illegal. If we follow their logic, that's where it leads.
Thanks for the call,
Marty.
Can they
make it past the barricades that Oak Park has put up in the name of tolerance?
Mm-hmm. Not that you actually would want any kid to go to Oak Park River Forest if you wanted them to get an education. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, I think we ought to go by what this woman's saying and play black music. We can get, Snoop Dogg, Jay-Z, and all the other rappers find out the number of the songs that they got that they use the N-word most, and then go sit out in front of the a church with a giant speaker and play those, play 20 songs over and over, and just using the N-word, 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 N-word to show them how much we support the cause. I think that's worthwhile.
Thanks for the call, Greg. I believe the musical selection for Easter Mass at First United will include Baby Got Back from Sir Mix-a-Lot. So you'll look forward to that if you're attending Easter service at First United. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, if I'm feeling black, can I get in on the reparations? Hey, Dan, you know, you're right. You go outside of like Champaign area, and you don't hear about all these murders being committed in Chicago. I believe there was close to 600 murdered blacks by blacks in Chicago last year. And they ought to drop that girl off and do some panhandling over at 63rd and Racine, and then we'll see how she feels. Thank you.
All right, Larry. Tony, Downers Grove.
Dan, are you being purposely naive?
Yes,
you know
is.
It's all about getting a seat at the table in every facet, and then things will change because nobody's addressing the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that have been put into all these areas, and still nothing's changed. We just need change in leadership, Dan, and you're being naive.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Thousands of dollars? I mean, you mean $30 trillion in Great Society programs over the last 50 years? That money? Something else I wanted to talk about, just in terms of violence. How about in the womb?
Oh.
How about the self-inflicted wounds of killing children? Just inexplicably looking to Planned Parenthood as some protector of black families as opposed to destroyer of black families, the incidence of abortion in the black community. When you start with the destruction of the family through violence, and that doesn't, we talk about ripple effects with crime victims and criminals in neighborhoods or communities. What about the ripple effects of family destruction? Yes, through terrible incentives with government welfare programs, but family destruction that starts with a violent act. There's a pro-life documentary that was done by these social media influencers. They're super popular. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're the LeBrants. They're this young, attractive couple, which is probably why they're popular. But they're actually pretty sharp, too. Cole and Savannah LeBrant are their names. They did a 40-minute video that they posted on Instagram. They've got 10 million followers on Instagram, 13 million YouTube subscribers, where they very neutrally talk to former abortionists, including people that we've talked to on this show, Kathy Altman, as well as Tony Leventino, about abortion. And it just asked the questions based on the stated positions of both sides. And one of the stated positions of the Planned Parenthood side, the pro-abortion side, the violent side, is that they're actually doing something that they're not doing. In our the Orwellian world in which we live, where freedom is slavery, Planned Parenthood is saving lives. And particularly women, saving women. And this was a question that they put to Tony Leventino, who, by the way, as I said, former abortionist, and he told the story on the show. I mean, it's a heartbreaking story. Why did he stop performing abortions? When his what was the moment, the epiphany he had? When his daughter, young daughter, was tragically killed in a car accident. But here's what he says to his career as an OBJYN, so his experience, and this argument that's made by the pro-abortion crowd that they're saving women's lives.
We need abortion to save women's lives. Hear it all the time. For 9 years, I worked at a medical center where it's what's called a tertiary referral center. It's a hospital that is equipped with the doctors and the equipment to take care of high-risk pregnancies. We don't do this in every hospital because it's too expensive. So we have centers where this occurs all through the country. And where I worked was a tertiary referral center. And for 9 years, as a pro-life obstetrician gynecologist, I worked in a medical center like this. I saw it all. means severe heart disease, cancers, out-of-control diabetes, preeclampsia. I mean, these are dangerous pregnancies. Pregnancy can be very dangerous. But there's a point to be made about this. We need abortion to save women's lives, really. The vast majority of times that a pregnancy becomes dangerous to a woman with many of these conditions, there are a few cases early in pregnancy, we can talk about those, but the vast, vast, vast number of these cases occur after 22 weeks when the baby's viable. I have determined, as a pro-life obstetrician gynecologist and almost 10 years of experience in a tertiary medical center, I have terminated, i.e. ended, hundreds of pregnancies to save women's lives. How many babies did I have to deliberately kill in the process? None. Not even one. It's called delivery. When the lady comes in, for instance, with that preeclampsia patient, 27 weeks pregnant, real case, her blood pressure is 220 over 160. And we've got to get her delivered now, because the only way to cure preeclampsia is to end the pregnancy. We're going to deliver this baby by cesarean section because it would be fast. I can do that within an hour. And we're going to take care of the both of them, and we're going to just have to leave it in God's hands. And we did exactly that. We stabilized her, delivered her, and she and the baby ultimately did great.
Mm-hmm. You want to start healing old wounds, stop opening new ones. How about that as part of the talk of reparations and restorative justice? Dan and John Cass in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and famed columnist John Cass, johncassnews.com, where you get his columns now, in for Amy J. this morning. And John, the left continues its unrelenting assault on the Florida parents' rights legislation and any such legislation like it. MSNBC yesterday, of course it was MSNBC, interview of a Florida kindergarten teacher named Corey Bernhardt on the bill and how this has negatively impacted his ability to be a kindergarten teacher in Florida, so he says.
Yeah, it's twofold. It really hits hard in my heart professionally and personally both. Professionally, it truly makes me feel like I am not trusted as a professional. I know my kindergarten standards through and through, and nowhere in our curriculum does it have anything about teaching sexual orientation or sexual identity. So for them to say that's happening, it's kind of crazy. We should be able to have discussions, and that's what we're encouraged to do in kindergarten. And then personally, because my kids do have questions. They want to know who my partner is in pictures outside of my classroom, and I should be able to speak to that.
It's not part of the curriculum, but I should be able to speak to precisely what the legislation seeks to empower and what and how and why the legislation seeks to empower parents when it comes to their kids in the primary grades.
This is nonsense. Kids are always interested in what their teachers do. Teachers are the authority figure in their lives. But you know what kids really care about? Like when they're seven, they care about nights, they care about, sports, they don't care about the sex lives of their teachers or the proclivities of their teachers. Mm-hmm. And to even go there is ridiculous and proves the point, and I'm glad I wrote that last week about Disney, and I'd never, ever take, if my kids were 5 years old now, which they're not, I wouldn't take.
And you're also, your family has a number of educators in it. So the discussions you've had with the teachers in your family about this business and the response you're getting from a select group of teachers that is being amplified by the D.C. press corps, of course.
Of course it is. Most teachers, I don't think many teachers really want to get into their sex life. I think they'd rather.
But a few really do.
But a few really do, and these are the ones that are held up as the standard by left-wing media, meaning most mainstream media, and people don't like it. Parents don't like it. They don't want to deal with it, and I support them.
For more on this, please be joined by Bethany Mandel. She's editor at Ricochet.com, contributing writer for Deseret News, and editor and board member of Heroes of Liberty. Bethany, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what about, I thought the interesting thing too, that this kindergarten teacher said, speaking of kindergarten. You don't trust me professionally. Is that what this legislation is saying, is that parents don't trust teachers?
No, I don't think it's saying that parents don't trust teachers, but I think it is saying that parents are the ultimate deciders on what their children should be exposed to and when, especially when it comes to, you know, grades K through three, which is what this legislation applies to. And so, you know, they're showing their own hands. They're saying, you know, kids aren't being taught this in the curriculum, but I want to have the freedom to talk about this with them anyway. And
right.
He says that they're not learning about sexuality. They're sort of learning about his own personal life. I don't want my children. I don't care. You can say I went to the zoo last weekend without ever saying anything about your life. When I was growing up, we didn't know anything about our teachers. And I think that there's some sort of psychological stuff at play here that, you know, in our current generation of millennials, we feel like we need to share everything, and everyone needs to be validated all the time. And these teachers need like emotional validation from kindergartners. And I don't totally understand that, because at the end of the day, it's about the kids. It's not about the teachers. And I think that we've all lost sight of the fact that the most important people in a school system are the children. And, you know, with the school closures over the course of the last year and a half, 2 years, we've talked a lot about how, teachers are at risk, blah, 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 and there's been very little conversation about what all of these mitigation efforts have done to children. And that's a sort of a running theme in sort of adults in the last 2-3 years, is that the priority is their feelings and it's not the well-being and safety of children.
Go ahead, John.
But Bethany, as the father of a teacher, as the husband of a teacher, I can tell you that teachers who may not agree with this radical leftist belief on indoctrinating children are sometimes feel that they have to stay silent lest they themselves be accused of violation of rights.
Absolutely, that's right. I mean, we see it with the sort of mob mentality on the left. If you don't completely validate my personal experience and my personal belief, this is an assault. This is violence. Silence is violence. Words is violence. There's nothing that isn't violence to the left anymore.
Except actual violence.
Also, this
survey, too. I mean, it's interesting because I don't think they care. Maybe some within the Disney corporate structure, starting with its CEO, who was reticent to get involved, but was, you know, essentially prodded into doing so. But this activist class doesn't. 7 in 10 Americans say they do not want to do business with Disney anymore, and will seek out family-friendly alternatives. 68% now less likely to do business with Disney. Of those, 57% much less likely. So a supermajority less likely, with a clear majority vehemently less likely. Intensity there.
Wow. That's honestly a little bit surprising, because it's sort of one has to wonder how much regular Americans are paying attention to this stuff. But I think that Disney's sort of making it clear that their bread and butter is no longer the American family. Their bread and butter is now sort of the single 20, 30, 40 somethings that are there for sort of solo pleasure trips. And I happened to accidentally be one of those at the end of February. I was in Orlando on a work trip and had a day to burn. And I went to Disney with a girlfriend. We had a great time. But I think that it's really short-sighted because I had a great time because I sort of had that emotional attachment to Disney from my childhood. And kids growing up now won't have that emotional attachment. I just wrote a column for Fox News, I think it was last week, and I talked about how we were planning on going to Disney, and I wasn't going to take a promised Disney trip away from my kids because of all this, because after the last 2 years, there's only so much you can keep on taking away from kids in the interest of fairness to them. And so I was like, you know what? We'll do this one and only Disney trip, and then we're done with Disney. And then I priced out the tickets, and it was close to $3,000 just to walk in the parks without doing anything. And so I think that they're making clear that their bread and butter is no longer families like mine with lots of young kids. It's the single 20 and 30 something.
Well, right. The pleasure trips too. And particularly, just from those videos that were surfaced by Christopher Rufo and others of executives, yeah, and producers talking about how their aim is to insinuate more LGBTQIA plus characters and messages into their content. And that would certainly also be visited upon the theme parks and that experience as well. And so, you know, it's like the teachers, it's a small group, but that group is very politically active, very outspoken, and does a pretty good job, as we've seen throughout our civic and cultural institutions, of getting the majorities to cower and let them have the run of the place.
Yeah, and that's the part that I really don't understand about sort of Disney's calculations, because the parks I get, and it's pretty easy to escape all this sort of gender ideology stuff in a theme park, because at the end of the day, you're just riding rides. But in actual content, this is a huge issue. While I was willing to let my kids have one last Disney trip, we're done with Disney on the media content side. I'm not interested in screening everything. And they are very open about their agenda, and it does not align with our family values. And their bread and butter for media content is families, and not just the media content, but also all the licensing. 20-something-year-olds are not throwing Disney-themed birthday parties with plates and cups and balloons and all of those things.
Right.
They seem to be throwing their lot in with the childless and with sort of the Chinese who are having their children.
Yes.
So that to me is like a massive miscalculation on their part. It's why so many different sort of right-wing media companies are starting to go their own. The Daily Wire is starting their own content. On the book side at Heroes of Liberty, we're publishing more wholesome books. Tuttle Twins is doing the same. There's lots of us out there who are sort of stepping into the void. And I think that Disney has really, really miscalculated their stranglehold on the American heart and mind. Because at the end of the day, I'm not interested in continuing this relationship if it's going to be an abusive one.
But they do have the media behind them. They do have the media in terms of, and by media, I mean corporate, leftist, mainstream media,
yeah,
that is corrupt.
You know, yeah, but look who's watching it.
They yeah, keep repeating, look at CNN's numbers. Yeah.
Right, but they keep repeating, like, this is a don't say gay bill, constantly.
Right, right.
It's almost like the drive to go to war in Ukraine, constant.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, people are voting with their feet and they're running with their dollars. So, you know, they're just screaming into the void. The tree falls in the forest and no one hears it. Did it actually fall? That's CNN right now. And those of us on the right, I mean, the Daily Wire is starting an entire media company for children. And, you know, people always say, well, you know, you're not entitled to, they kept on telling us, you're not entitled to books that you want and movies that you want, and yada, yada. And so Daily Wire and like us at Heroes of Liberty, we're like, okay, we'll just build our own. And we are, and we're getting the media coverage in conservative media because there is a thirst for this kind of content that is not controlled by Disney and by all these corporations. their stranglehold on the American mind and psyche and wallet is coming to an end. And I think that they're not going to realize it until it's too late.
She is Bethany Mandel, editor at Ricochet.com and editor and board member of Heroes of Liberty, she was just describing. Bethany, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And she joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, the great John Cass. Find his columns at johncassnews.com. Reasonably priced subscriptions are available, so why don't you buy one? Put it in your kid's Easter basket. How's that?
Give the gift of common sense. I keep telling people.
Exactly. Nobody listens. No, some people listen. Speaking of people that only a few people are listening to, the president was in Iowa yesterday to do some pandering on ethanol and continue to propagate his Putin propaganda. Take a listen.
Putin's invasion of Ukraine has driven up gas prices and food prices all over the world. The two largest grain producers in the world, Ukraine and Russia, are not doing what they usually do, so everything's going up. We saw today's inflation data. 70% of the increase in prices in March came from Putin's price hike in gasoline. We need to address this challenge with an urgency that it demands. That's why I've called on Congress to move immediately to lower the cost of families' utility bills, prescription drug bills, and more, while lowering the deficit to reduce inflationary pressures. And that's what we've done. We lowered the deficit by $300 billion so far.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Nothing gets prices under control like price controls.
Dan, one minute.
Then he went on to make his momentous announcement. I want to get to his momentous announcement, then you can chime in.
I'm doing everything within my power by executive orders to bring down the price and address the Putin price hike. In fact, we've already made progress since March inflation data was collected. Your family budget, your ability to fill up your tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war and commits genocide in a half a world away. To help deal with this Putin price hike, I've authorized the release of 1 million barrels per day for the next 6 months from our strategic petroleum reserve.
1 million barrels, John.
And then he's going to talk about his travels across the Himalayas with Xi Jinping for 17,000 miles, where they really got to know each other. But then said, I don't know if that's the fact, but I'm just saying it, or something like that, along with his, hunting in the creek. This nonsense continues because the media allows him the big lie.
1 million barrels, which represents 5% of America's daily consumption of petroleum. 1 million. 20 million barrels a day in the U.S. That's number one. Number two, as the Wall Street Journal opined, the inflation trend began in earnest a year ago at the onset of the Biden presidency. It's accelerated for most of the last 12 months, long before Putin invaded Ukraine. The timing reflects too much money chasing too few goods, owing mainly to the combination of vast federal spending and easy monetary policy, both things that Joe Biden and the socialists are big fans of. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Govzilla author, economist. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Good morning. By the way, I did work briefly as a presidential speechwriter many, many years ago. And when I hear Biden reading these words, because, of course, he's just reading what's coming off the teleprompter, I see these guys, in the basement of the Oval Office writing these. Maybe people will believe this. Well, maybe people will believe that. I mean, it's all just spin coming out of the White House. These numbers are really atrocious with what's happening when you have 8.5% rise in prices and you have 5.5% rise in wages. You don't have to be a math genius to realize people are getting poorer every month under Biden because your paycheck is not keeping pace with what you're paying at the cash register. So people are suffering a decline in their incomes. And I go back to January of 2021, last month that Trump was in office. Do you guys know what the inflation rate was that month?
2%.
Yeah, pretty close. You're too high. It was about 1.6 or 1.7%. So think about that for a minute. Let's just reflect on that for a minute, folks. 14 months ago, the inflation rate was 1.7%, which is actually below the Fed's target. They want inflation running at about 2%. I can live with that, 2%. And now we've gone from 1.7% in 14 months to 8.5%. I mean, the question I would cast to you guys is, how do you screw things up so quickly? In only 14 months, Joe Biden went from 1.7 to 8.5% inflation. It is a direct result of Biden's policies. Now, you know, when he keeps talking about, I'm doing everything I can to keep oil and gas and food prices low. No, let's be very clear about this. They want high gas prices. They hate oil. They hate gas. They don't want you to use it. They want to force you to buy electric cars. So if you don't want people to use these satanic fuels, oil and gas, which is what they regard them as, then you want high prices. Biden came in. His first act as president was killing the Keystone XL pipeline, because you need pipelines if you're going to get the oil and gas from North Dakota and Oklahoma and Texas to you know, throughout the country and then hopefully to export it. And they killed that. They put in place. Remember, Biden also put a moratorium on all drilling on federal lands. We have something like $30 trillion of oil and gas under federal lands. They banned that. I could go on and on, but it's just an outright lie for them to say they're doing everything they can to bring gas prices down. So you can tell I'm frustrated, because this was not an act of nature. It was not Vladimir Putin. He might have contributed a little bit to these higher prices. But as you just said, Dan, this has been 14 months in the making, and it's getting worse, not better. It's not temporary. What was the word they used to not temporary.
Transitory.
Transitory, yeah, that was the word. You know, this isn't transitory. It doesn't look too transitory to me.
How much worse would it have been if he got his last multi-trillion-dollar bill through?
That's a great question. John, you know, you just nailed it, my friend. I mean, can you imagine? Thank God for Joe Manchin. And did you see, by the way, did you guys see that statement Manchin put out yesterday? I mean, it was pretty tough. It basically went after Biden and said, we got to stop all this spending. We got to stop all this, you know, war on American fossil fuels. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. But you are so right, John. I mean, can you imagine how bad this inflation rate would be if Biden had passed that $5 trillion Build Back Better bill? I mean, we'd probably be talking about 15% inflation right now. Thank God we were able. And just last week, Chuckie Schumer and Biden got together at the White House, and they put out a statement saying we're going to make another push for this. These people are crazy. They're lunatics.
Should Republicans call for a reduction on tariffs on certain sectors to reduce the cost to Americans of certain household
goods? Yeah,
there's
one example. Yeah, it's a good point. You know, one of the things that's really – oh, let me – before I answer that, I would just make one other point. You know, do you know what the solution, according to Joe Biden, is – For the problem that we have with high gas prices, paying $5 a gallon, we're going to put more corn in our tank. We're going to put more corn in there.
Right.
Well, have
15%.
You looked at what happened to corn prices? I mean, corn is a fundamental staple of our food, not just for, you know, we eat corn, but also for livestock and so on. If you start putting all the corn in the tank, guess what? The price of food is going to go up through the roof. I don't think that they are such deep thinkers that they can figure that out. But one of the things that's going up really dramatically in cost has been fertilizer. You know, and you obviously need fertilizer for our agriculture. And those prices have gone through the roof because, in part, we put these tariffs and quotas on how much fertilizer can come into the country. So that's a good example of how these tariffs can raise prices as well.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
the components are made in our mined in Russia and Ukraine, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have more natural resources, folks, than any other country in the world. We have more minerals. We have more coal. We have more oil, gas. We've got all this stuff. It's not like a, it's not, America is greatly and richly endowed by our Creator with incredible resources, and they won't let us get at them. And, you know, you reduce the supply of something and its price goes up.
Yeah, we're learning that the leg bone is connected to the ankle bone and so forth. Yes,
exactly.
Steve, you mentioned this last week. You gave us a bit of a preview, and then it's been published, so I want to revisit it. This is a study that you and Casey Mulligan and Phil Kirpin did, looking at the 50 states' response to COVID and scoring the response across the impact on economy, education, and mortality. Give us the... the best, the states that had the best outcomes and the states that had the worst.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to depress people any more than we already have. But, you know, we did probably the most comprehensive study. It's been published in the National Bureau of Economic Research, so that's one of the most prestigious economic journals. And we did a, you know, thorough analysis looking at, as you said, the mortality rates. You know, did state officials keep their citizens safe and healthy? We also looked at what happened with the economy. Did you keep people out of the unemployment lines? Did you, you know, prevent your businesses from going bankrupt? And then we looked at schools. Did you keep your schools open? Because I think, I mean, you have one of the wisest audiences, Dan. So, you know, your people who listen to this show understand this, even though liberals don't. Shutting down the schools was a catastrophic mistake that did incredible damage to our children. I love how liberals talk about the children all the time. They were the ones who pushed these school closures, which were really damaging. Anyway, the bottom line is this. So, Illinois, you're going to breathe a relief here. Illinois was not the worst state. It was not the worst state. It was the fourth worst state. So congratulations to Illinois. I can't imagine that people in Illinois would reelect Pritzker. I mean, I can't imagine people would be that stupid. He has been the worst, not the worst governor, but about the third or fourth worst governor. Illinois had a high death rate. It's had a high number of business failures and high unemployment rate, and it shut down its schools more than just about any other state. So somebody tell me what Pritzker did right.
Well, and the other interesting thing about this study that you published, when you look at the states that did the best across these metrics you measured, a lot of them are smaller states with homogenous populations in the top 10, with one exception, the state of Florida, a big, diverse state run by the best governor in the country.
That's exactly right. And so Florida, I mean, let's just go back 2 years ago. Remember when, do you guys remember when Cuomo used to have those press conferences? Andrew Cuomo?
Riveting.
Oh my God. Remember the press? Oh my God. He's so smart. He should be the president of the United States, not Donald Trump. He's just a brilliant governor. Of course, he had the worst record of any governor in America in terms of dealing with COVID. Of course, he had to resign in disgrace. But
Brian Stelter had to put his head in ice water after.
Exactly. That. And then on the other end, remember, you know, they'd show these pictures of, you know, people at the beaches in Florida. And what is wrong with Ron DeSantis? We should call him Ron DeSantis. He's killing all his citizens. He's the most irresponsible governor. Well, it turns out DeSantis had one of the best records of any governor. And you're right, Dan. I don't know if he's the best governor in America, but he's certainly in the top three. And then you've got, Cuomo, and then you've got people like, Pritzker and Murphy in Connecticut, New Jersey. Yeah. And these governors completely screwed everything up. And here's why this is important. This isn't just, settling scores. Did you see what happened in Philadelphia yesterday?
Yeah, return of the mask.
They've reinstated mask requirements. A number of states are going back to wearing masks. It's like we've learned nothing. The bottom line of our study, folks, is very simple. Lockdown did not work. Let me say that again, because some people don't, the politicians may be hard of hearing. Lockdowns were a failure. They did not stop the spread of the virus, but they did great damage to their economies and their businesses and their children. Never, never, never again should we do this. And yet here we are 2 years later, and you read the Washington Post and the New York Times or watch CNN, you'd think that lockdowns were a success. They were not. They were not. Illinois has a higher death rate than Florida, but Florida was wide open, and Illinois was completely shut down.
He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, GovZilla author. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is John Cass, famed Chicago columnist, where you can find his work now at johncassnews.com.
And the podcast that's
Chicago Way.
Almost as good as Dan's, the Chicago Way. Yeah.
There you go. All right, johncassnews.com. John, you've heard me talking about, I don't know if we've had the chance to discuss this, but this this seemingly straightforward position one could take that is treated as evidence that you're a Russian asset. And the position is this. Putin is a communist thug. No use for Putin. Don't like autocrats as a matter of rule. Don't like Putin's revanchist fantasies. All for supporting people defending their homeland against a foreign invader like Putin into Ukraine for all sorts of reasons. But I also recognize that Zelensky is not George Washington. He's not Winston, he's not Winston Churchill. This is not the American Revolutionary War. And to suggest that, you know, this is somebody that we're supporting out of convenience to an extent because the aggressor is that much worse. Why can't we just have sort of a positively utilitarian discussion of this without getting into, you know, who loves Zelensky more? And if you don't love him sufficiently, like, say, Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes, that level of love, then you're somehow in bed with the Ruskies.
The left in America and the war party right in America, particularly the Republicans and some of the Democrats who want to make money. Yes, who want to make money on the side with the defense contractors, at least contributing to their political reelection funds. Yeah, it's an odd combination.
So what you're saying is Eisenhower was right. There is a military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Ted Galen Carpenter, Senior Fellow in Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, contributing editor at the American Conservative as well. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dan.
So what about that? Can we is it such a needle to thread to say, let's provide weapons to the Ukrainians to defend themselves from Russian aggression, but let's not get over our skis in terms of who Zelensky is and what Ukraine is with respect to the kind of country that is in terms of its freedom and its respect for individual rights and those sorts of things that we have come to appreciate in this country?
Well, it should be a relatively easy task to make that separation, and it's a very important one. One can condemn Russian aggression against Ukraine, even though there were plenty of provocations with NATO expansion and so on. But still, Ukraine, like any other country, did not deserve to be invaded in this fashion. But you don't have to portray it as this model democracy, this democratic model that so terrifies Vladimir Putin that that's the reason he invaded. Ukraine is nothing of the sort. It's a highly corrupt, increasingly authoritarian operation. And I think Americans deserve to know the truth about that. Our news media, as usual, seem to be covering up that rather disagreeable feature.
You know, I think it was Cliff May on the show, but I may be mistaken, but the observation was this, that the difference between Russia and Ukraine in terms of level of corruption, in terms of who is in charge of the government, Putin is an autocrat who manipulated the oligarchs, the kleptocrats, to rise to power and to extend his power. So Putin controls the oligarchs. In Ukraine, over the last several presidents, it's been different kleptocrats who control the different presidents.
That's well put. The organization that gives the most comprehensive measurements of corruption in the world, Transparency International, put Ukraine in the worst third of the 180 countries surveyed. Russia was just modestly behind that. As notorious as Russia's corruption is, you certainly have to understand that Ukraine is not much better. And when Americans think about this, if this country is going to skate close to the line and risk possible war with Russia, we need to know what our client is. And our client is highly corrupt, and it is increasingly authoritarian, outlawing opposition parties, jailing opposition leaders, shutting down opposition media outlets. This is not the characteristic of a legitimate democracy. And Freedom House, which does the ratings on democratic values and civil liberties, puts Ukraine in the partly free category, just barely ahead of Rodrigo Duterte's Philippines, where you have death squads and other massive abuses. So this is not the Denmark of Eastern Europe.
But the empire, let's say the war party, continues to strike back. You can see them going after J.D. Vance in Ohio. Meanwhile, the Zelensky brought along to the Greek parliament, at least on video, a member of the neo-Nazi Azov regime. And that's ignored by media. So I guess the larger question to you is, what is this partnership between the war party and the American political left that keeps fronting and pushing for collision with Russia? What is that about?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think for the people on the right, the war party wing of the Republican Party, it really is they are tools of the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
For the people on the left, it's a little more complicated. They tend to believe their own crusading rhetoric, never mind the wreckage that that has created throughout many parts of the world. One need only look at places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and you get a full picture of how bad that approach to world affairs has been. But they will crawl into bed with the likes of Liz Cheney and
Graham,
be willing to support very aggressive policies that have extremely destructive effects.
Well, you know, and they're completely unbounded by their own suggested standard. So, for example, it's remarkable the reaction to the re-election of Viktor Orban in Hungary. And I'm no fan of Viktor Orban, who's also an autocrat. And Trump was wrong to, you know, make overtures and say positive things about Viktor Orban. But let's hold on a second. An economist named Anders Aslund tweeting out something that's sort of consistent with the position you've heard from the D.C. press corps on the occasion of Orban's reelection by the people of Hungary. Anders Aslund tweeted out, "If Hungary really votes overwhelmingly against democracy and for corruption, I cannot see why it should be accepted in the EU. Kick it out." Okay, so Hungary on that Freedom House index is rated as more free than Ukraine. Yet Zelensky is a hero of the Ukrainian revolution, akin to George Washington, and Orban and Hungary needs to be kicked out of the EU because of the choice that the Hungarian people made.
Yeah, there certainly does appear to be a rather graphic inconsistency in that position. And it's true. I mean, Hungary does not rank well in terms of its democracy index, but it does rank ahead of Ukraine by about 8 points on a 1-to-100-point scale, which is not trivial. And the level of corruption, likewise, is not nearly as bad as it is in Ukraine. So it's pretty hard to understand why the why Ukraine is being portrayed as this wonderful country, and Hungary is condemned for the sin, apparently, of re-electing a political figure that the conventional left in the United States dislike. That's too bad. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Viktor Orban either, but the Hungarian people voted overwhelmingly for him and his party. And one would think there's an incentive for us to accept the results of a democratic election. Apparently not. If they vote the wrong way, people be condemned for that, and the government needs to be sanctioned.
So, Ted, I really like your piece, whitewashing Ukraine's corruption, and I religiously, and I mean that literally, read the American Conservative and Cato publications, but I'm still going to have to go back to this American left Ukraine flag on your Twitter feeds and your Twitter handle. Why is the left so enthralled with Ukraine when they were opposed, rightfully so, and I was wrong, back in the day with Iraq and the invasion of Iraq? Why are they so supportive of Ukraine now?
I think it's more that they're rabidly hostile to Vladimir Putin, that any country that is crosswise with Russia automatically gets sympathy, and they understand the tactics here. You cannot be honest about the mixed nature of that victim and expect the American people to rally around a policy that, quite frankly, is flirting with a dangerous involvement in a war with a nuclear armed power. You can't do that. You have to portray the victim as the most innocent, wonderful country.
Like America.
In the world.
Well, Jefferson, Jefferson, Washington, Ben Franklin in Ukraine.
There's no daylight, apparently, right, between America's interests and Ukraine's interests.
This hostility towards Putin and Russia is sort of newfound. These were the same set of people that were aghast that Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union the evil empire. We're sympathetic. Bernie Sanders, you know, spent his honeymoon in Moscow enjoying puppet shows. They were apologists for the Soviet Union, the Politburo, the communists, of which Putin is a relic. They are quiet, largely, about President Xi and the Chinese communists. But for some reason, Putin, now in power, they don't like this communist. They apologize for Hugo Chavez and for Nicolas Maduro, for Fidel Castro. This communist in particular, I wonder what this communist means to them, different from the other communists they either support or are apologists for. Maybe it has something to do with them continuing to perpetrate the fraud that they committed on the country for much of the last 5 years, that the former president and Putin were allies, were colluders, stole the 2016 election through Russian manipulation.
They don't regard Putin as a communist. If anything, they regard him as an odious right-wing leader. And you see all sorts of accounts to that effect. The social conservatism in Russia, they do not really see Putin as a communist. And the fact that Russia has adopted a very assertive foreign policy, if not an outright aggressive one in this case, they will make the distinction that China has not done so, apparently forgetting about Tibet, apparently forgetting about the Chinese invasion of North Vietnam, or Vietnam by that time, in 1979, the threats against Taiwan, that apparently hasn't registered with them, or at least they don't want to acknowledge it.
They were happy to ignore the...
He is an evil right-wing leader, not a communist.
Oh, they were, and they were also happy to ignore that Iron Curtain that descended from Trieste, from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic for about 50 years, too. They were happy to ignore that.
Well, some were, some weren't. You know, there's always been a faction within certainly the Democratic Party that has favored a very hardline policy all along. That has been pretty consistent. You do get some of the people further left who did indeed adopt a much different policy view toward the Soviet Union than they have toward what they regard as an odious right-wing, if not fascist, power in post-Soviet Russia.
But you
had a pro-war faction within the left throughout the Cold War, too.
Yeah, that's fair. With respect to Zelensky, too, to his credit, shrewd, it seems to me one thing he understands, given his background in entertainment, is if you're good on TV, you can whip people into a frenzy. And you can push the greatest powers in the world around and dictate policy to them, which is essentially what he's been able to do.
Well, it helps when you have the news media as a key ally, willing to push that propaganda. Because if the news media are hostile, you may have the best arguments in the world, and you're going to have those spun so that they come out in a very negative fashion. All you have to do is look at the treatment, for example, of former Representative Tulsi Gabbard. By all lights, she should be the darling of the progressive left. Her views on domestic policy are decidedly left of center.
Yeah.
But she adopted an attitude of hostility toward the war party, toward the policies that it recommends, toward the military-industrial complex, toward humanitarian, so-called humanitarian wars, and regime change wars around the world. And that made her anathema. A woman of color, left of center, a young, dynamic, great speaker, one would think she would have been the ideal candidate for president.
And instead,
Donald Trump in 2020.
And instead, we know from Hillary Clinton.
He deviated on that issue, and that was enough.
Yeah, and we now know from Hillary Clinton she's a Russian asset.
Oh, well, anytime you go against the prevailing pro-war policy, no matter who you are, you're a Russian asset, according to these people.
He is Ted Galen Carpenter, Senior Fellow in Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and a contributing editor of the American Conservative as well. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com, where you can subscribe to John Cass's musings. You can also get his The Chicago Way podcast. And, John, we were talking a bit earlier in the program about Mayor Triple Threat's reelection chances. And we were talking about the resurgence of COVID restrictions like the indoor mask mandate in Philadelphia. And sort of the intersection of the two, civic leaders Laura and Brooke Skinner Ricketts, commercial insurance executive Charles Smith, and restaurateur Sam Sanchez have been named finance committee co-chairs for Lori Lightfoot's reelection campaign.
Wow. Isn't that something?
Sam Sanchez, who's the chairman of the Illinois Restaurant Association. His company is Third Coast Hospitality, which includes the following restaurants you should never go to again if you have: Treehouse Chicago, Moe's Cantina, Old Crow Smokehouse, Cava Room, Encanto, Tunnel, and Luna. We got to get back. I got to finalize post that list of businesses you should patronize and businesses you shouldn't, if you want to have any institutional memory of who did what during the lockdowns and.
But I mean, that's
ascribe responsibility, ascribe benefits or consequences accordingly. So
she destroyed their businesses.
Co-chair of her finance committee, yeah. Sam Sanchez, Illinois Restaurant Association. So tell me again how it's inconceivable that Triple Threat gets reelected. I mean, this is like a new depth that the combine, as you termed it, the bipartisan combine, have achieved in my mind. All of the talk of bailouts and putting up the celebrity chefs like Rick Bayless to talk about more bailouts after the first round of bailouts. Bailouts as recently as, you know, a month ago. More money, more money. And they were lockstep with Lightfoot. They bitched a little, mostly just to get more cash from the city to complement the cash that was coming from the federal and state. And I don't begrudge restaurants or any other business from getting the PPP money because the government shut down your business. I do begrudge them falling in line with the lockdowners.
Well, you know, the Illinois Restaurant Association has not led properly over a period of time.
That's an understatement.
And their members are angry at the leadership.
Yeah, but they've lost
their businesses. They've lost. You know what? When you have a business, and I know now that I'm, because I am in business for myself, you risk your life savings. You risk everything. And then here comes the government shutting you down on BS.
When do people who are apprised of what's going on respond accordingly and not just go along even when they disagree? Why are some restaurants who would be aghast if they knew this, and they now do, why are they members of the Illinois Restaurant Association? What is it exactly you're getting in terms of benefit from that trade organization?
Right.
I mean, we get some collegiality and you know, networking and so on and so forth. Fine. You can do that on your own in that industry, particularly an industry as connected as the restaurant industry in Chicago, Chicagoland, Illinois. I mean, or if you're going to stay, somebody stand up at a meeting and say, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
It's easy for you big boys to play the rent-seeking game with the politicians. Meanwhile, as you were just saying, John,
the diner? Yeah.
Yeah, my business is going south. My business is going under. We talked to Steve Moore in the 7:30 hour about the index that he and a couple of other economists created to assess the state response. And he talked about how, Illinois is in the bottom four in terms of mortality rate, the combination of mortality rates, school lockdowns and shutdowns, and the number of businesses that fail, the economic impact of the lockdowns. And yet here you go, one of the scions of old man Ricketts, who's, you know, a cajillionaire because of her dad, Joe, and she puts, you know, her identity politics ahead of any sense when it comes to who you're going to support for mayor. That's even separate and distinct from Sam Sanchez. That's an affront.
Wait, isn't Sam Sanchez a developer or a construction guy? I think it's EMC Construction, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know.
It's nice to have friends at City Hall if you're in the construction business. I'm just saying. It's all nonsense.
Sam Sanchez is the founder of Samco Enterprises and Third Coast. He's the first Mexican-American elected as chairman of the Illinois Restaurant Association. Oh, congratulations. Who cares?
And EMC Construction, Inc., yeah, Sam Sanchez.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You want to know the answer to the question, how can somebody like Lori Lightfoot get reelected? How can somebody like J.B. Pritzker get reelected? Look no further than this case study.
Look, the same rent seekers who are around her now are going to try to find a candidate. I would assume the Daily's Billy Johnny and all the rest might look favorably upon, say, a Brian Hopkins. It's all who you know
Brian
and how you.
Hopkins.
You're, yeah, we talked about that on texts.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, that, I get, you know, I guess he's a nice enough guy. He's a mope. I mean, he's another, you know, room temperature IQ seat filler in the city council. But I take your point, but that the point is to say, right, so he's the marionette and the puppet masters would be the dailies behind him. So there's their candidate.
And then what about that big development on the north side? What's it called again? You know, that Lori was going to fight and then she backed down.
Yards?
What? Yards, yeah. I think that was Hopkins.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Politicians in Philadelphia putting masks on. The politicians and the business community, such as it is in the city, falling in line with the business community falling in line with the lockdowners in Chicago. In California, I want to get this in too, because Dr. Jay Bhattacharya has been such a friend of the show and such a stalwart with respect to the COVIDian policy throughout the last 2 years. He's a Stanford medical doctor, although he doesn't practice, he teaches. He's also an economist, brilliant guy, and he was one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, along with Sunetra Gupta of Oxford and Martin Kulldorff of Harvard. You know, all these idiots who don't know anything about science and data, right? And anyway, of course, excoriated because they were out of step with the TV doctors, starting with Fauci. Well, legislation now in California, and don't be surprised if this comes to Illinois as well, would put a muzzle on doctors. Assembly Bill 2098 in California, and Jay Bhattacharya writes about this at Barry Weiss's Substack, physicians who deviate from an authorized set of beliefs would do so at risk of their medical license. The bill written by Assemblyman Evan Lowe, a Democrat in Silicon Valley, of course, and currently making its way through the California legislature, motivated by the idea that practicing doctors are spreading quote-unquote misinformation about the risks of COVID, its treatment, and the COVID vaccine. It declares physicians and surgeons who disseminate or promote misinformation or disinformation related to COVID-19, including false or misleading information regarding the nature and risks of the virus, its prevention and treatment, and the development, safety, and effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines, shall be subject to disciplinary action, including the potential loss of the medical license.
It is highly insulting, but it's also it's indicative of the times when you have Dr. Fauci praised by the media, St. Fauci, trying to, quote, take down the Barrington Declaration.
Great Barrington Declaration, right. Well, and Francis Collins.
Yes.
We saw the emails. I mean, putting a muzzle on doctors, there's only one medical opinion, and it's whatever comes down from the TV doctors, the CDC doctors approved by the federal government and the media. This is Jacinda Ardern territory, the New Zealand PM. We are your single source of information about COVID. The single source of truth, the federal government and whoever the media endorses in addition to them, the allies in academia. By the way, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, has legislation similar to this at the federal level.
This is Orwellian on one hand, obviously, to those who are thinkers and those who listen to this program. But it's also bad public policy in terms of, what if a new virus comes or a new strain of what if China develops a new one in the lab that we'll never find out about?
No, that's easy. Then everybody sits on their hands until Rochelle Walensky or Tony Fauci says what time it is, and then you repeat what they said.
No, that's what they want you to do. They want you to sit on your balcony and the drone with the Biden
scream
head
into the night. Yes.
Yeah, the Biden head comes up and tells you that not to listen to your soul and stay calm. But in terms of real public policy, when you develop a system of that's full of distrust and rife of politics and agenda driven and revenge, that's not the best practice to convince people of what to do to deal with pathogens.
Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Hey, Dan, thanks for taking my call. Until people get who agree with you and are listening to you, instead of just yelling and nodding in agreement whether or not they're worried at work or whatever they're doing, until they start taking some action and get involved locally, nothing is going to change. And so that's what people have to do, because they listen to who's going to get them elected, who's going to get them voted. You have to get involved and get people. And it's not just the upcoming election in November. It's the primaries.
Yes.
There are Democratic candidates who want school choice and some of these other some of those other policies that we agree with. People have got to get involved locally now. Just complaining and nodding in the head is not enough.
Agreed.
Thanks, Kevin. Doug, South Loop.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it, but I read an article earlier today about the Disney engineer talking about how things are breaking out with regards to wokeness or you can apply to COVID. Basically, he's saying that, you know, people, employees with parents, their parents with kids tend to keep their mouth shut and watch their back. He said the really young people are all into the woke thing, but he said at the highest level, at the highest corporate level, that's where it's the most aggressive. And that's where they're all unanimous in going their current direction. And I'm just going to bounce the idea off. And there was a similar article, Hollywood Reporter or Variety, I forget which, talking about how in Hollywood, the higher you up on the food chain, everybody wants a knife in your back. Everybody wants your job. You cannot lose your job by taking, let's say, a family or a Christian position. I mean, you will lose your job by taking a family or Christian position. You cannot lose your job by taking the woke position. So the most effective thing you can do is use the weapon of wokeness or COVID or whatever the herd mentality is, and be the most aggressive, and that's the way you keep yourself from being a target. So it's just a cycle that can't really be broken, but I just want to get your reaction to that.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I mean, I don't know, John. I mean, I think there's something
He's
to
got
that.
A point. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But the flip side is to say, I mean, it's the conversation we had with Joe Perillo, and he agreed. What exactly can Lori Lightfoot do to you? Nothing. Nothing. He said, you know, she can't do. I mean, look, she can't do anything to me. I've had this run. I mean, yeah, I worry about my family and passing the business on and so forth. But I could take that car dealership out of the Gold Coast and I could put it in Hinsdale or Schaumburg.
Yeah, he can.
And make the same amount of money. The point is to say that there are people, yes, that are, you know, in positions that may be precarious. And so they have to sort of go along with the zeitgeist of those beneath them and those competing with them. And then there are people that are entities unto themselves and are completely insulated from, you know, the political retribution of these petty tyrants. And they don't do anything. They behave like Sam Sanchez. And that is not defensible.
They join up so that they can sacrifice others and try to stay alive. And what it happens throughout.
But that's a cop out. That's a cover story for them. It's not real.
It's the cover story. No, but they believe that if they run to the left, to the woke, and scream loudest against some demon out there in the darkness, that they will save themselves. And
maybe
it's just not possible. They
maybe
will not.
And frankly, to the extent that is true, and I know there's some truth to it, you know, that, again, look, being a little bit self-reflective, mm-hmm. that's, again, a failure of conservatives. It's a failure of common sense people to impose consequences, because they look and say that the left is motivated. They can impose some hurt. They can make my life annoying. Nobody on the right is going to say anything or say much of anything. So there's no consequences if I run afoul of common sense. There are consequences potentially if I run afoul of leftist lunacy. He is John Cass. I am Dan Proft, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773 467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.